forward seems too much. When you feel totally out of touch, hope is seeping out the door. You find yourself curled on the floor. The thoughts swirl round, all jumbled and messed. Why is this brain so darkly obsessed? I've secrets I've never confessed. Haven't told a soul. Gentle whisper through the pain. Remember rainbows follow rain. Breathe deeply, hold on tight. Your hope will return, shining bright. Embrace the now, release the past. In forgiveness, peace will last. You matter deeply. You're let your strength be shown.
Hello, hello. I am so glad to be back. And today I'm with my guest, Dave Roberts. Thank you so much for joining me, Dave.
You're quite welcome, Elaine. Thank you for inviting me. I've been looking forward to our conversation.
Yeah, me too. One quick word to the audience. We're still getting a little used to the new intro. I have to say, the song is called You Matter, and I wrote it. And it's bizarre to hear something that you've written. I'm not a songwriter, definitely not a singer or any of that, but it came out of what now amounts to 50 years of experience dealing in the suicide awareness space. And it means a lot to me, so I just thought I would share that. I'm going to have Dave give us a little bit of background information in who he is and what he does, and I think you'll find that fascinating, before we get into his story. As per usual, we're just going to go ahead and have a conversation. I really am glad to have you here, Dave. Tell us a bit about you.
Elaine, what seemed to be like a previous lifetime ago, I was an addictions professional working in an inpatient substance abuse treatment center in upstate New York. The majority of the clients we dealt with were not only had addiction issues to multiple drugs, but also had mental health issues as well, such as depression, schizophrenia, generalized anxiety disorder, you name it. So we were dealing with clients who also had a coexisting mental health diagnosis, which made treatment that much more challenging. I worked for, as I mentioned, for 27 years and retired in July of 2012, when I was 57 and had 30 years into both state and county retirement. Prior to retirement, I began working as an adjunct instructor at Utica University, where I was teaching the psychology department. I'm now an adjunct professor. I have been there for 22 years and currently teach primarily care of the human spirit, death, dying, and bereavement, impact of addiction on children and families, and recently a family stress and coping course. So primarily courses I teach of a clinical nature, and also a course that's related to the study of thanatology. A lot of your listeners might wonder, how did I jump from addiction to death?
Yeah.
Typically, I tell my students and I tell anybody that I speak with who asks me that question, that I did not embrace the field of thanatology by choice. Nobody wakes up and says, I'm going to study death for the rest of my life, because it's a topic that most of society wants to avoid at all costs. And for me, I never thought that would ever be part of the equation, that I would be dealing primarily in a service capacity with individuals who've had challenges with loss.
Yeah.
The universe doesn't give you the choice to say which challenges you're going to deal with. It just unfolds it. And our choice is we either deal with those challenges or we end up dying emotionally in a physical death if we don't. So I am no, with that, I'm no stranger to grief. I, in my 70 years of life, I have danced with death since I've been 5 years old, since the time that my father left, having my mother raise me as an only child, to the loss of my daughter's best friend about to be a year in July due to a car accident, and the loss of my mother, the maternal grandmother and aunt who raised me, numerous friends, pets, you name it. I have danced with grief since for as long as I can remember. However, the one loss that really just shattered my worldview and really caused me to take pause of everything that I stood for, my values, my beliefs, my priorities, is the transition. I call it transition as opposed to death or passing on or walking on as is in the Native American culture. And it's however you conceptualize death, but the transition of my 18-year-old daughter, Janine, over 22 years ago as a result of a rare and aggressive form of cancer. And She transitioned 10 months after giving birth to her first and her only child and my first grandchild. Her significant other and my granddaughter, Brianna, lived with us for 4 years because it was a promise that he made to Janine that he would not uproot his Brianna until she was ready for kindergarten. He stayed with us until she was about 5 years old. And fortunately, we had a good relationship with her and with him. He never prevented us from seeing him. And because in a lot of situations, many situations, because of those circumstances, a lot of times the parents are prevented from seeing the grandchild and it opens up another deep wound. So as much as grief as I experienced, this was a grief that my training didn't prepare me for. Mm-hmm. Education didn't prepare me for. I'll give you three dates, and this will just sum up how life can turn on a dime. May 2nd, 2002, my granddaughter was born. May 19th, 2002, I received word that I satisfactorily completed the requirements for my master's in social work degree, culminating a 25-year journey in higher education. And on May 26th, my daughter was officially diagnosed with cancer. And on June 2nd, we went to the Dana-Farber Research Hospital in Boston, which is one of the best hospitals in the world for pediatric sarcoma research and treatment. And in a 5-minute consult, they basically, and this is a condensed version, Elaine, basically told us there was no cure for her cancer. And the only hope we had was aggressive chemotherapy to put her cancer into remission until a cure could be found. So in that 5-minute consult, what I heard loud and clear is your daughter's going to die. Unless it's a miracle. So I went from the highs of being a grandfather to the satisfaction of getting my advanced degree to now being unwittingly involved in a terminal illness journey with my only daughter. And I have two sons, one younger than my daughter, Gina, one older. But my whole life was just turned upside down. And she transitioned 10 months after her diagnosis. She transitioned at home on March 1st, 2003 with hospice services. And that set me off on a path that I never even thought I would ever embrace. I ended up embracing that path, which I know sounds a little strange given the context of loss, but I did embrace that path. Mm-hmm. And with the help of support groups, with the help of gradually wanting to re-engage in life and try to do something positive through writing, through teaching, through doing grief workshops to try to help other individuals transcend challenge, I gradually began to re-engage in life. But the penultimate moment where everything just clicked for me was through pure serendipity, where I met an interfaith minister by the name of Reverend Patty Farino. And Elaine, it would take me another hour to tell your audience how we met. But let's just say if her computer did not black out when she was registering online for a conference that I was organizing, we would have never met. So she had to call me to register. We shared stories. She was involved at the time that I met her with the Angel of Hope in Long Island, New York. And the Angel of Hope is a statue that is erected in honor of children who have died. And she was doing ministry work with parents there. And so we shared stories. I shared stories of my daughter. And she asked me do you believe in science? I said, being a psychology person and a science-based person, I never really bought into that. But I think my daughter gave me a double rainbow on Father's Day. This was in 2009. And when she saw me at the conference, and I'm jumping ahead, I told her, if we see each other, I'm going to give you a big hug. So I saw her, gave her a hug. She whispered in my ear, I think your daughter sent me a rainbow. And I'm thinking, great, I'm tired. And I said, oh, that's great. But I was so tired, Elaine, at the end of the conference that I didn't really appreciate the gravity of this until later. So she said, if you ever get to Long Island, come and stay with me and my husband, and I'll show you my Long Island. So November, this was in September of 2010, 7 years after Janine transitioned. In November of 2010, I found myself at her home. We went to a workshop that our then colleague was putting on called Embracing the Power of Change. And that was a portent of things to come. After the conference, we went to her home. It was about 9:30 at night. She goes, get into something comfortable. I'm going to have you come into her sacred space, which is a fireplace and all kinds of very spiritually adorned materials. And from there, for that entire weekend, I began to believe in the survival of consciousness after death, that I believed that my daughter's spirit existed and that I could connect with it at any time. And one of the things that she told me in retrospect, and this was after the experience, was that on September 3rd, this was about a week before the conference, or 2 weeks before the conference, she was on Route 17 in New Jersey. Her husband saw this magnificent rainbow going from one end of Route 17 to the other. And for those of your American listeners who know New Jersey and Route 17, that's one of the, I think, major thoroughfares in New Jersey. And there wasn't a rain cloud in the sky. There wasn't a rainstorm. Her husband said, we got to take a picture of this. So they videotaped it. And all of a sudden, she's sitting on her car and she heard a voice in her head saying, I need you to talk to my father. And she said, I'd be glad to. And I get chills telling this part of the story. She goes, I'd be glad to, but who's your father? It's the guy that you talked to about the conference. So we were destined through divine intervention to meet when we met. And I really firmly believe that my daughter got us together. From there, we spent 10 marathon conversations over the next 10 years talking about how psychology and spirituality could work together to help individuals transcend challenge. So every time Patty threw out a teaching to me, a spiritual teaching, I would look to see how it would align with psychology. And I'd call her up and say, I think this could work. So what I learned to do through her is not abandon my core beliefs, but expand on that to include other perspectives that could change my perspective and give me a greater understanding of myself and my relationship to the world around me. So this is how this all happened. For 10 years, I really just said, we ought to write a book about what you did for me. People need to know this. People need to know about our conversations, about the experience that you facilitated, and how it's possible to find peace. So finally, during the pandemic in 2020, she was in South Carolina at the time. We wrote the book through Google Docs. We published it. We rolled it out on March 1st, 2021, was March 1st is the date, the month and day of my daughter's transition. And it's called When the Psychology Professor Met the Minister. It's a book about one of my spiritually transformative experiences that she facilitated, a sampling of our conversations that can show us how psychology and spirituality can merge together to help us transcend challenge, and also the importance of critical thinking for the future and present generations to expand our perspectives. And the other thing that the work that I did with Janine, that she helped me facilitate with Janine, also helped me do ancestral healing, understanding, and to forgive my father for leaving when I was 5 years old, and to also understand why my mother was so overprotective with me after she left. I was angry at my mother for her overprotectiveness and angry at my father for leaving. But the work that I did with Janine facilitated me looking at my past with my father and my mother with the help of both Patty and another shamanistic holistic practitioner by the name of Susan Roback, who between the two of them helped me piece that together and have me find peace not only with my daughter's transition, but with my father's decision to leave and my mother's decision to overprotect me. And this perspective, this integration of psychology and spirituality has informed everything that I do now. It informs my teaching, it informs my service work. And what I tell individuals, Elaine, is what you believe, I'm not going to challenge that, because what you believe is what you believe. And as it's not hurting you or anybody else, it's all good. But be open to other perspectives that you can put in, you can add to your core beliefs to help you get a greater understanding of the world around you. Don't be afraid to critically think. Don't be afraid to embrace other perspectives that can align with what your core beliefs are. It isn't about substituting your core other beliefs for your core beliefs. It's in addition to. This is what Patty was taught during her time in the seminary, and this is what she taught me, and this is what I try to teach others.
I think that is so critically important, what you just said. Because when you were talking about melding the psychology with the spiritual, I'm a firm believer in everything that is out there. Okay, I'm what I call a recovering Catholic. I grew up Catholic. I am now spiritual. I am not Catholic. However, in all of the religions, in all of the spiritual teaching, in Buddhism, in Hinduism, in all of these things, there are nuggets of truth that you can bring together to augment the beliefs you have. And when you really start to look at some of them, some of the far-flung religions and spirituality and what have you, they really do have a lot in common.
Yep.
And melding the science, melding the psychology with the spirituality, to me, only makes sense because we are all energy. That's been proven, okay? Yep. It's not woo, it's not out there. It's stone cold fact.
Yep.
And building on that with everything else that's out there, I know watching my parents who had to go through an awful lot with both of their children basically dying and being very ill. It's a lot to take, and other people in the family and their religion, that faith is what got them through those tough times. So that is something that I see valuable. It's not something I had. It's not something that I found within that religion. But I absolutely understood that they did, and it was a huge boon to them to make it through those tough times.
Yeah, like you, I'm a recovering Catholic as well, too. And I would be considered, I'm going to take a quote from one of my favorite authors, Kent Nerburn, who calls himself a guerrilla spiritualist. And that's what I am. I take a little bit of Buddhism, Native American teachings of animals and nature, some aspects of scripture and Catholicism, nature therapy, all of that informs my awareness of the world. Spirituality is very individualized, and it's about what practices are going to resonate with your belief system that are going to help you gain a greater awareness of yourself and feel connected to something greater than yourself and give us greater purpose. Spirituality in and of itself, individuals have a high sense of spirituality or place a high sense of importance on spirituality. It's protective against mental health, mental illness, against depression. Mm-hmm. Having that sense of spirituality gives us a sense of purpose, not only to ourselves, but to others.
Yeah.
And a sense of connectivity, which is what we need as human beings. We were not made to live in isolation.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I don't think many animals were made to live in isolation, but particularly not humans.
Yep.
And one thing that I find sad is that in the Western world, we have gone to the nuclear family. And that really, I think, leaves a big hole in learning. And, you know, the what is it they say? It takes a village to raise a child. Yeah, it really does. And I'm very fortunate because my parents not only brought me to Canada with them, but instead of bringing material goods, they took that money and they brought my grandmother and my aunt with us, because family is what's most important.
Yep.
And that's how I grew up. And those were the things that mattered. And I think I'm very blessed to have been brought up in that sort of a family. We certainly were not perfect or quiet or any of those things. And we were pretty much dirt poor, but we lacked for nothing in terms of joy and understanding that being together and laughter doesn't cost anything.
No. And my version of family when I was growing up was all the relatives were kind of like close to each other. Everybody lived within a few blocks of each other. I lived with my mother, my maternal grandmother, and my maternal aunt. Together, they raised me. So that was our idea of family. And I even believe in the Native American culture is that they have a very extended meaning of family, where the uncle might take the role, let's say, of a counselor to a child because the father may not be objective enough for whatever reason to be able to do that. And I'm paraphrasing, and I don't, in terms of what I understand, but everybody who's affiliated with the extended family has some type of a role with that child. And we can learn a lot from that in terms of the definition of family that goes beyond the nuclear family. And that literally it does take a village and it takes a group of individuals outside of the family to raise that child and to instill them with the principles that are going to allow them to make a positive mark in the world.
Absolutely. And because we came to this country so far away, it was just my mom, my dad, myself, and my grandmother, my aunt, and then my parents had my sister. So we were a very small family, but you gravitate to the people like you. And so we have an extended Canadian family of Scots people that just became aunts and uncles because we were our little port in a storm because we had the same beliefs. We came from the same strata of life, if you will, in Scotland. And that's how it was done. And when my Uncle Alec got ill, my parents took in my Aunt Margaret and the boys. And when my father's sister died, my Uncle Alex stepped up in like 10 minutes and put my father on a plane to go home to Scotland to deal with that. I was 7 years old at the time. And it's just, when you see that as a child, those are the things that really impact you. Yeah. And it wasn't that we were a great big family because it was just my sister and I. But seeing other family, like big families, was really interesting because we didn't have that. But the close knit, we often saw it in the people that had a lot of kids. They had that same very close knit. Everybody kind of looked out for somebody else. And that's my grandmother used to say all the time, needs must. And as a kid, I thought that was the stupidest thing to say. I thought, what the hell does that mean? But as an adult, I understand. Yeah, needs must. When you need, you must find a way within the family to function, to go on, or everything stops.
Yep.
And I come from hardworking people who were not afraid to get down on their knees and work hard. It was just the way it was. And I'm very grateful for that.
Yeah. And my mother modeled that too. She always worked hard. She never complained. She always was grateful for what she had. She instilled a moral fiber in me where I knew right from wrong. She was very supportive of anything that I did. And I think as I got older and I started looking back on my relationship with her, there's a lot of things that I wish I had done differently. And hindsight's always 20/20, but I've made peace with that. I've been silent prayer to her. And that's the other thing I've learned. It's just not Janine who's in my circle. It's all my other ancestors who have gone before her. Yeah. Janine is part of this great universal oneness that that can influence everything that I do. And it's just not her. It's everybody else that has meant something to me in my life that has had an impact that is now on the other side, that have walked on, that have passed on, that have transitioned, that I draw inspiration from every day. Yeah. And on my desk, I have an ancestral altar where I have pictures of my father, pictures of my mother, my grandmother, pictures of my daughter, and also my two beloved cats. I have their cremains as well there too. So it's like anytime that I want to remember or connect, all I got to do is look.
And this is something friends and I were talking about last week. In the past few weeks, it's the age we're at, okay? A bunch of our friends are losing their parents, if they haven't already. And we were talking about the fact that in our family and in some of my friends' families, my two youngest grandchildren are at the moment 11 and 8. And my grandmother died in 1985, so they never met her. They didn't even get to meet my mom because she died in 2012. And yet, when we're having dinner, when the whole family's together and we're talking about something, they'll often make a joke about, oh, Gran would have done such and such, or Granny would have liked whatever, because we talk about everybody that's gone so much. They're with us. And the kids feel the same way. It's only the older kids that got to meet any of the, like my grandmother or my aunt or what have you. And it's really interesting because it's up to us to retain those memories. Yep. Because all the wisdom, all the goodness, all the joy they brought to us in life, I love that we get to carry that on by maintaining their memories. And I do the same now with my friend Andrea and the other people that I have sadly lost to suicide, because I think it's really important that we say their names.
Yes, absolutely. And it's important that we talk about them in the present tense because they're still a part of our families.
Absolutely.
And that keeps the memories alive. It keeps the continued bond with them alive. And it also preserves the history of your family. Because one of the biggest mistakes I think that can be made is not talking about somebody because somebody else in the family may not know that person. It's important to keep that history alive. It's important to keep their memory alive because they will forever be a part of your family.
Oh, absolutely. And I think of it like when I meet new people, well, I didn't know them before. I need to find out things about them to become friends with them. So why would it be any different with people that were in my life for however long? I want to maintain that memory and maintain it for the generations that come after us. What is it they say? If you don't remember history, you're doomed to repeat it.
Yep.
That goes for the good stuff too. You want to maintain the good stuff. You want to keep the traditions alive. You have to pass those on.
And I think Friedrich Nietzsche, the German philosopher, said something to the fact that, and I'm going to paraphrase this, if you deny your past, you deny your existence.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So the past is, everything I did in the past is dictated the choices I've made in the present. Everything in the past is connected with the present. If you take a look at Native American Crow medicine, Crow is, and this is in Jamie Sams's and David Carson's book, Medicine Cards, honor the past as your teacher, honor the present as your creation, honor the future as your inspiration. It's past, present, and future all coming together to help us determine the kind of world that we want to live in and help us to co-create our own reality in conjunction with the universe.
Oh, absolutely. And just one thing you had said, you talked about your two cats. I think it's really important that we also maintain the pets we've had in our lives, because it's the only way that we can teach children how to manage death and not be terrified of death or not be, I was terrible up until a number of years ago, where don't talk about it. I don't want to know my grand's getting old. I don't want to know any of that. Don't talk about that. And my father thought it was hilarious to always say to me, don't you worry about it. I'm still grass side up. Or I'm not leaving this house until I leave boots up. Dad, that's horrible. He's no, it's real life. Like, you have to deal with that. I'm blessed. I had him till he was 92. And we just lost him this year. And I was talking to someone about a month ago. And I said, yeah, my father is my hero. And she said, oh, that's nice. You're still talking in the present because he just died. And I said, no, because he's still my father.
Absolutely.
He will always be my father.
Yeah. Relationships don't die because the physical body does.
No, not at all.
And it's not pathological. It's not an indication of mental illness or any type of pathology if we continue to remember. Continuing to remember is a way that we move through grief. It's a way that we integrate our grief so that we can re-engage in life with meaning and acceptance, accepting that our world is going to be the way it is without the physical presence of our loved ones, but yet we're willing to engage in life regardless. And I also say acceptance does not mean closure. There's never closure to a life. It's been over 22 years since Janine transitioned. There are days I want her here. There's days I yearn for her physical presence. But it's part of the human experience. And I've also looked at that now as another reminder of my love for her. The pain that I have now of her lack of presence is no longer a curse for me. It's a reminder of the love that I still have for her. And that's never going to die. And when we meet again, it's going to be one hell of a reunion when we meet. But until then, I'm going to be as service as I can for as long as I can.
Part of that for me, I believe that I call it the grief train. I believe we get on the grief train with the first person that we lose, however that may be. And in essence, we never really get off again. We can stop in certain stations for a while, but it allows us to build empathy and to share stories with those who get on the train with us and those who may not be handling it as well, or maybe we're not handling it as well at that time. And I believe it is an ongoing journey for the rest of your human life. The grief train is part of that journey. And that's, I think, part of what unites us as humans too.
And it's not only grief due to death, but it's due to other associated losses. It's divorce, moving, it's selling a home. Grief is interwoven into the fabric of our life.
Yeah.
And there's no getting away from it. So it's like, how do we coexist with it? How do we make friends with it? How do we find meaning as a result of it?
Yeah.
That's the challenge that we have. That's the task that we have for as long as we're living the human experience.
Yeah. And I think it's good to examine our feelings. And it's so important now because this is part of the problem for men who have been brought up in the patriarchy to be so stoic and so lacking in feeling. It's really hard. We're starting to see cracks now, and people like yourself are understanding that you have to go through the feelings in order to function and be mentally healthy and what have you. And those changes, we're making incremental changes now, thank God, because we lose way too many men because of the silence and the stoicism that It's no longer that kind of world, and we need to be super open about people being able to share their feelings with those around them, and also taking the time to reach out to people, particularly the men in our lives, and just ask, are you okay? Really, are you okay today? Because a lot of times people just say that and somebody will say fine and leave it. And the next thing you know, they're gone. Because fine is not a good answer. Fine just means you're avoiding the question.
And I think part of it is sometimes I think society's belief that men are supposed to be tough, are supposed to handle, be the problem solvers, take their family's problems on their shoulders, and be the protector of the family. But men feel just as intensely as women. We just deal with it differently. We may not emote, but we work through our feelings either through activity, through problem solving. But one of the most poignant things that happened to me is I was in the hospital when my daughter was going through chemotherapy. And there were times, Elaine, I didn't know what was worse, her cancer or the chemo.
Yeah.
And I was sitting there while she was sleeping. And I was sitting there with my head bound down, wondering how in the world am I going to get through the fact that I'm going to likely lose the love of my, the love of my life, the apple of my eye. How am I going to work through that? And all of a sudden, this nurse came up to me and she just put her hand on my hand and said, "Are you okay?" And I choked up and I didn't tell her I wasn't okay. I just choked up and I just, but she knew I wasn't. That's why she asked me.
Yeah.
And she was the one person that did not assume my stoicism. She did not assume that I was strong. She did not assume that I was getting through this. She knew I was hurt and she asked me. And that's all it took. And I almost lost it. I got really emotional because she took the time to say, "Hey, I know you're hurting too. It isn't just your wife. It isn't just your kids. I know you are too." And that meant a lot to me, that one little gesture.
Yeah. And it is so important. And I've told this story before, but when I was, I guess about 12 or 13, we had gone home to Scotland. And for one, I don't know what happened. I don't know the backstory. I just know in the middle of the night, I woke up and my mom and dad were sitting on the edge of the couch. And my dad was slumped over and it was like my mother was comforting him. And it was like somebody threw cold water on me. Like, this is not supposed to happen. That's my father. Like, he's the rock. And my mother knew that I was there. And my mother tried to work through this with me for the next few months because it completely changed how I felt about my father. I was so confused as to what was going on. And as a teenager, it was just that time of hormone soup and everything is, I wasn't allowed to go to dances and yada. And I can remember saying to my mother, "Oh, I don't even like him." And she said, "Do one thing for me. If you never do anything else, I will never ask you for another thing. Do not ever say that to your father." I thought, okay, that's weird. And it was only maybe a couple of weeks when, I don't know if I saw the light or what happened, but he was my dad again. And whatever had happened didn't matter because I didn't know. It was weird because I spent the next 2 years disliking my grandfather. And it wasn't anything that I should have disliked him for. It's just funny how we internalize things that don't make sense to us. But I never did tell my dad that I didn't like him. And I'm really grateful that I didn't, because he was a very gentle person. And my mother knew that.
Yep. And and when we get to the afterlife, all of that stuff doesn't matter. All of the indiscretions that we had is with the human contract, all of the conflicts, it's all about love and light in the afterlife. And just from reading accounts of individuals who've had near-death experiences, what they've seen, what they've experienced, that's what it's all about. Love, light, and there's no animosity. I've had people ask me, "Do you think my father's going to be upset with me?" No. In the afterlife, all of that stuff goes. We live the human experience. We contract for certain experiences with each other in this lifetime. Our souls contract, and it's all meant, the experiences that we have are all meant for the evolution of our soul and the greater, and for the karmic resolution of past lifetimes of interactions. But the human experience, we're not supposed to understand that, to that. We're not supposed to remember all our past lives because it would basically...
Oh, my God. Yeah, that would be weird.
It would basically interfere with the contract we had in this lifetime.
Yeah.
Although there's past life regression therapists that will allow you to, that will hook into that. But and individuals who can read the Akashic records that can give you some idea as well too. And when that happens, and so I've had that happen to me through interactions with other spiritual teachers where I've come to understand my roles in another lifetime. And I said, this makes sense in this lifetime, but the human experience a lot of times doesn't allow us to understand for the depth of it. And maybe we're not supposed to in many ways.
Yeah. I have a spiritual teacher who said that two things, souls travel in packs.
Yep.
So you will have certain commonalities with people. You'll wonder why you hit it off so well. And the other thing is that the souls choose the human experience.
Yep.
And that's, some people are into roller coasters and some people are into the teacups.
Yep.
And roller coasters aren't necessarily the greatest things.
No.
If that's what you choose. But those who choose it, you always have that free will to change your mind.
Absolutely. The soul has free will to stay in an eternal state of energy. They have the free will to choose their existence. And what they said about soul packs, it's very similar to the work of Brian Weiss, who talked about the same group of souls will travel through lifetimes together, and they will contract with different relationships with each other for the evolution of the souls of that group. So it's very consistent with Weiss's work with past life and past life regressions.
Yeah, my spiritual teacher, I will say one last thing. My son, a few years into my working with her, he nicknamed her the holistic missile because she got right to the heart of the matter.
I like that. That'd be a heck of a brand.
Yeah, it was. She's retired now, but we took it and ran with it.
I would have too. That's priceless.
Yeah. This has been a very interesting discussion. I can't say how much my heart sits with yours for Janine and what she had to go through with and what you went through with on behalf of her as well. I love that you have a granddaughter that allows Janine to still not just be with you, but also be with you in that bigger sense, which I think is really quite wonderful. I'd like to leave our audience with one little tip or tweak that you use every day that just helps you make life a little better.
I'm going to take this from one of my favorite books, Tuesdays with Maury by Mitch Albom. And Maury Schwartz was a Jewish agnostic, but he was very spiritual. Okay. And he embraced meditation. He embraced Buddhism. One of the things that, and this sticks with me, and he asked Mitch Albom in the book, if there's a bird on your shoulder, and that bird told you that today is the last day of your life, how would you choose to live it? So for me, I would tell everybody, live each day as if that bird on your shoulder is telling you it's the last day of your life. How would you choose to make that day meaningful?
Oh, that's wonderful.
And that's what I live with, because I'm grateful. As I get older, I'm grateful for the fact that I get up and take nourishment in the morning. I'm grateful for God, the universe, that has given me another day of life to do what I love doing. So I try to live each day as if I got that bird on my shoulder telling me, today is it. How are you going to choose to live it?
Oh, that is absolutely beautiful. I love that. I love that. Dave Roberts, thank you ever so much. You'll see the link down below for Dave's book, and all the information will be right below us in the show notes and transcripts along with Dave's bio and how you can connect with him should you wish to. I thank you so much, Dave, for coming and chatting with us. I thank our audience for being here. And as per usual, I always say, make the very most of your today, every day. And we're going to see you next time. So bye for now.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for being here for another inspiring episode of Suicide Zen Forgiveness. We appreciate you tuning in. Please subscribe and download on your favorite service and check out SZF's YouTube channel or Facebook community. If you have the chance to leave a 5-star rating or review, it'd be greatly appreciated. Please refer this to a friend you know who may benefit from the hope and inspiration from our guests. Suicide Zen Forgiveness was brought to you by the following sponsors. Truul Social Media, the digital integration specialists. Let them get you rocking page one in the search results. Canada's keynote humorist Judy Kroon, motivational speaker, comedian, author, and stand-up coach at Second City. Judy has been involved for over a decade in the City Street Outreach Program in Toronto. Do you have a story to share? Do you know someone you think would be a great guest? Please go to SZF42.com. And for our American listeners, that's SZF42.com. Thank you for listening, and we hope to see you again.
Through the pain, we all belong together in hope, because you matter.